Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, this is Bruce Webster. Good evening, this is Bruce Webster. Okay, sorry. This is my first time running the board here on The Interpreter Radio Show, so pardon me if we sort of fade in and out here as I try to adjust it. We have myself here in studio. We have Chris Fredrickson. And we have Kevin Christensen. And actually, I have failed to actually bring proper introductory information about both Chris and Kevin, so I'll let them each introduce themselves. Chris, tell us about yourself.
I teach part-time at the university and have taught in religion, women's studies, honors, and the history departments. And my PhD's in modern European history, 19th century, and I'm particularly interested, and I've taught church history, Doctrine and Covenants up at BYU. And so, yeah, that's just, and then wonderful husband and six wonderful children and in-laws and grandchildren, and yeah, great life.
The whole thing. Kevin, how about you? Kevin, are you there? Do we have you on the line? Oops. Well, we're still... there we go.
There I am.
There you are.
Okay, there we
are. Sorry, I thought I had turned your button on, but now it's on.
Yeah, this is Kevin Christensen. I work as a technical writer currently for a company called ANSYS, and been working for them for 14 years. And before that, I worked in Kansas. And before that, I worked in California. And before that, I served a mission in England, and before that, I grew up in Utah, and I have an English degree from San Jose State, and I've published a number of things through Farms and Interpreter and Dialogue and Sunstone and various other places.
I'm Bruce Webster. I'm on the Board of Editors for the Interpreter Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to basically defense of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from an academic point of view. My own background is in information technology. I'm basically a geek in a suit. But I'm best known in the Interpreter Foundation as being the one who does the barbecue, all the smoked brisket and pork at the annual Interpreter Dinner. So I think that's why they let me hang
around. Yeah, and let me jump in here. And if you don't join for any other reason, get on the board so you can come to that barbecue because it's fabulous.
Okay, so we're now 2 weeks post-general conference. I think we still have some interesting topics to discuss. One of the things I want to cover tonight, I have noted in 50 years of church membership, that, and particularly over the last, I'd say 20 to 30 years, there is a common criticism you find from critics inside and outside the church that somehow the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve Apostles are a bunch of cloistered old men who really don't understand the world, don't have any significant background, and just sort of sit in their ivory tower and do stuff. My experience over those 50 years is actually quite different from that. But I'd like to talk about some of that tonight. and I'll start by correcting myself slightly. When I was on 2 weeks ago, I mentioned a figure that was wrong. Someone else had said it, and I hadn't checked it thoroughly. They said that President Nelson had graduated from med school by age 21. It turns out that's incorrect. He was 23. and that was 2 years after he graduated from college at age 21. So he, by the time 2 years post-grad, he had his MD. And of course, as has been documented many times elsewhere, he went on, became a world-renowned pioneer in cardiac surgery, was and is still very well known for that around the world, and speaks Mandarin. I don't know if he
taught himself.
Yeah, taught himself Mandarin.
He did hire some tutors, I understand.
Yeah. But and is currently on a world tour as a president with stops in Jerusalem, two stops in Africa, a stop in India.
Started in England.
Mm-hmm. And a stop in Hong Kong. So this is quite interesting. Now Chris and I are of an age, though I think she's much less of an age than I am.
I wish I was, but I'm probably not.
I'm very reminded of both the, particularly the start of President Spencer W. Kimball's presidency, where he had unlike President Nelson, he'd actually had significant health problems, mm-hmm. Was not expected to outlive President Lee, who was young and vigorous, and died abruptly 18 months into his term as president. And President Kimball turned out to be one of the most significant prophets of the Restoration. It was quite amazing to live through that period of time, to literally sustain in conference new scriptures being added to the Doctrine and Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price, to have the revelation on the priesthood, to have his classic talk when the whole world would be converted, to watch the missionary population double, and to watch the church grow during that period. I have the sense that we may see something of the same thing in President Nelson's administration, however long or short that is. Any thoughts? Chris, Kevin?
I'll jump in here on President Nelson. I was having a conversation with a friend the other day about this very topic, about how he has been so well prepared. And, you know, I'll start off one of the things, and, you know, we all have regrets in life, but one of the things that I am particularly, that's particularly notable to me about President Nelson and all of these great leaders of the churches, they're certainly not perfect. None of us are perfect. But there, you know, every prophet that we read about in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, they're archetypes of Jesus Christ in some form or another. But they have their weaknesses. They're not the Savior by any stretch of the imagination. But here's someone who has been so perfectly prepared because he chose righteousness. All the way through, he has made them, and he's the most disciplined individual. He, you know, wakes at 4:30 when the prophet says, read the Book of Mormon. He reads the Book of Mormon. Everything he's been asked to do in anticipation of, you know, his experiences in China, he took it upon himself to learn the language. And then was, of course, engaging with those people. And then when this very famous opera star, who's iconic in China, needed the surgery, they reached out to the best and brightest in the world, and they brought Elder Nelson over. And so, you know, one of the things we forget sometimes as members of the church is, as a history major, after that war, the Opium War in China, Hong Kong goes to the British, and it's a lease to the British. And so during the time that it's under British control, we built a temple in Hong Kong, but the reality is today we have a temple in China. And that's a significant fact, and I don't think that should be lost on anyone. So to my mind, here is a prophet who is perfectly poised to reach out to these extraordinary people in China, and I anticipate extraordinary things from him. And again, because of his decision, you know, every step along the way, to do what the Lord asked him to do and to be obedient to the principles of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I think that's an example, and it certainly is a model for each of us, that with obedience we will see extraordinary things in our life as well. And these men are not disconnected from the world at all. They've had all the same challenges, if not, and I would suggest even more challenges than we have, just by virtue of Satan wants to stand in their way. And so, and they understand, they have the pulse of the people around the world because they go everywhere and they reach out and they touch people and they, you know, and they interact with these people, and they're very hands-on in what they do in terms of knowing and trying to understand and then seeking, you know, information from the people and then direction from the Lord. And they understand what's going on better than we can ever possibly imagine. So I revere, I mean, I love them.
Yeah. Kevin, thoughts?
Well, I'd say I'll be having my 64th birthday this month, so I've been through quite a few since, you know, growing up, and it was President McKay, and being in Salt Lake City in 78 when the revelation on the priesthood was announced, and, you know, just feeling and seeing and hearing, you know, horns honking, there was definitely, it was taken very well with enthusiasm. And going up through and just the last conference with so much just willingness to change, and seeing one of the things that I like about the church structure is that there's this balance between having being tossed around by, you know, every wind of doctrine. You know, there's the warning in Ephesians 4. That's why they're supposed to have prophets. There's supposed to be something that keeps you from being tossed about. But as I say, time, there's a mechanism for change because it's ongoing revelation. It's just not static. And so it's something that I've appreciated. And also just even the idea of a prophet. You know, one of the things I did starting on my mission was I wrote an essay for Fair Mormon on biblical keys for discerning true and false prophets. And so it's a matter of one of the things I learned from that was it's what people decide is important about what they're looking at. Because we all have choices when we look at them. There's any number of things we could pick out as being what's the most significant thing about this person. And it can be something negative, it can be something positive, but best, it's what's relevant to the question. And one of the things I learned from the scriptures was what's most relevant to the question is, you know, what is a prophet? And I found that there are 28 biblical tests for discerning true and false prophets, which is far more than most people talk about. You know, and usually there's only two or three that people know about. But it turned out to be that those are the ones that are the easiest to fix the answer, you know, to be able to choose the test that's easiest to manipulate rather than the whole collection. And the whole collection reduces things very well. So I can, you know, say, yeah, I'm very impressed by these men and what they've done and the inspiration that clearly comes through them. Despite they're all clearly being very human, very, they're people and they have their human side, but they also have their, you know, this clear education, expertise, talent, broad experience, and inspiration from God.
Thank you. No, those are all excellent points. So, in preparing for tonight's show, I went through and looked at the educational and, to a certain extent, business background of the current members of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve. We have two doctors, three lawyers, one commercial pilot, four businessmen, three academics, one, Garrett Gong, whom we've talked about because I know him personally, with extensive foreign service and government policy experience, and an accountant. Now, that in and of itself is a pretty extraordinary, what you might say, a board of directors or executive board for any organization.
Which one is the commercial pilot again?
Yeah, because we never hear about it. Actually, what I didn't realize till I went through this is that Elder Uchtdorf was a fighter pilot in the West German Air Force during the most tense period of the Cold War, basically 1959 to 1965. Mm-hmm. This is the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is the time when the Fulda Gap was seen as the invasion point of Russia from Eastern Europe into Western Europe. And so he was quite literally on the front lines of the prospect of World War II through that period.
But he was the Lufthansa pilot, too, that when that plane was hijacked, that was chosen to follow that plane and then to land and to fly the plane back.
Ah, I didn't know that one.
It was extraordinary.
Now, let's talk about a few of the other brethren. President Oaks. President Oaks is my personal favorite because he started as president at BYU my freshman year as I started. And I developed a great love for him as an undergraduate. I watched him negotiate through some very difficult and tricky issues with Title IX, federal efforts to impose certain changes on BYU, and just sort of this ducking and weaving he did to hold the federal government at bay while maintaining the integrity of BYU itself. Mm-hmm. Of course, he graduated from the University of Chicago Law School. He clerked for the Chief Justice of the then Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren, was a law professor, served as president of BYU both when I was an undergraduate. When I was an undergraduate. He was gone by the time he came back. Oops, and we're now going into break. This is the Interpreter Radio Show, and we will see you again after the break. And we're back. I Welcome back to the Interpreter Radio Show. At some point here, the music will fade away. Glad to have you here, Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, nonprofit LDS apologetics. You can go to MormonInterpreter.com and InterpreterFoundation.org. We have literally hundreds of articles, blog posts, podcasts, video roundtables for you gospel doctrine teachers, and resources that you can rely upon. And of course, we have your radio show. This is Bruce Webster. I'm here with Chris Fredrickson and Kevin Christensen. We're starting to talk about President Dallin H. Oaks. My wife really loves his talks because she says all his talks are like legal briefs, which, of course, is appropriate. He tends to address the topic, lay out, here's what I'm going to talk about, here are the arguments, and so on. And I got cut off before I mentioned, besides being president of BYU, he spent 4 years as a Supreme Court justice in Utah. Henry B. Eyring, second counselor in the first presidency, has a B.S. in physics from the U of U. His dad, of course, was a world-famous chemist. But after he got his B.S., Elder Eyring said he decided science really wasn't for him, and he got his MBA and PhD in business administration from Harvard. Taught at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and was spent two terms as LDS Church Commissioner of Education. And always gives wonderful talks, and I empathize with him greatly because he always chokes up at the microphone, and I tend to have that problem as well. I'm trying to see if we're getting enough volume here. Okay. Thoughts on President Oaks and President Eyring? Kevin, we'll go back to you first, and then we'll go to Chris. Kevin?
Well, I always enjoy President Eyring's talks. He's, you know, you can tell that he has a scientific mind, but also deep spiritual insight. And it's the same with President Oaks. I've read his book on the assassination at Carthage, and it's a really fine piece of scholarship. Mm-hmm. You know, it still holds up. It's still the standard text on the topic. So mm-hmm. It's a pleasure to listen to these men each time.
Mm-hmm. Chris, some thoughts.
Elder Oaks is, as a lawyer, is extraordinary, and he brings that legal mind to defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so he does exactly what he does, what you would do in a courtroom, is you are in defense of, and then you are presenting evidence. And he's linear, he's clinical, and the logic is absolutely exquisite when he speaks. His conference talk this time I thought was one for the ages. It was just extraordinary. Elder Eyring brings that sweetness and that gentleness that is so touching to individuals that, for me, it helps me reflect on, you know, where I am in my spiritual development and the enormous amount of growth that's necessary to become childlike. I see that kind of childlike quality in him that is so appealing in a world that's growing less and less civil, but it is exactly the kind of character that we see in the Savior Jesus Christ. And we see this in all of these men, but that tenderness is just right there on his sleeve. So I love Elder Eyring as well.
The President M. Russell Ballard, acting president of the Quorum of the Twelve, is, I think, it's currently the only member of the first presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve who does not have an there is one other who does not have an actual college degree. He was actually a highly successful car salesman.
honest car salesman. That's
honest
what
car
makes
salesman.
Him stand out.
Yes, actually, he tells a story on himself that Ford approached him and wanted him to open the Edsel dealership in Salt Lake City. And he pondered it and prayed about it and thought it was a really bad idea. And Ford came back and talked to him and talked him into doing it anyway. And he says it was one of the worst business decisions of his entire life. But that's a good counterpoint. It's not all academic. The viewpoints of much of the leadership of the church are grounded in real-world concerns and real-world issues. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey R. Holland. Now, I have a confession to make. I absolutely loved President Holland when he was president of BYU. I graduated in 78, came back and taught at BYU for 2 years, 1985 to 1987, and President Holland was then president of BYU, and I didn't like him. And I'm embarrassed horribly to say that now, but there was just something about him that sort of irritated me, and I feel horribly embarrassed because I think he is probably one of the best and most powerful speakers in church history. Everyone pretty much just waits for his talks because they are humorous, they are spiritual, they are insightful, they are incredibly well written and incredibly well delivered. He has that very fearless, robust, and yet self-deprecating style that is wonderful. And it's I would say at this point, without generalizing too much, I would say that most members always want to hear President Holland's talk and Elder Uchtdorf's talks. Those are the two. Thoughts, Chris?
I wait for Elder Holland's talks. I love his talks, but he is, I think, one of the most exquisite wordsmiths on the planet, right up there with C.S. Lewis, and that's saying something. Nobody's better with the language than the British, but he has this ability. But what he brings to his task is his enthusiasm for what he does and his absolute conviction that God is on our side, that he loves us, that he cares about us, that we can be forgiven over and over and over again and never, never to give up. And that's what I adore about Elder Holland, is when he is done, you just feel so uplifted and inspired, and it's like, okay, I can get up and keep trying.
Kevin?
Yeah, my wife, Shauna, was at BYU when he was there, and so she developed a connection with him, and that's continued and intensified, you know, as the years have gone on, and he's come into the Quorum of the Twelve. I have very fond memories, especially of the talk that he gave about Joseph and Hiram Carthage reading the Book of Mormon and mm-hmm. pulling out the actual copy of the Book of Mormon that they had with them at the time and showing, where the pages were folded down to mark specific verses, and there's a tremendous intensity in the spirituality and empathy that came across, to show that their absolute utmost, their sincerity was demonstrated by how they treated the book itself at that moment when they knew they were facing death. It's a marvelous testimony.
And we should note, since we're talking academic credentials, that President Holland has got a bachelor's in English and a master's in religious education from BYU, and then has a master's and a PhD in American Studies from Harvard. Which explains a lot of his academic and wordsmithing depth. Now, President Uchtdorf, the conference crush of many church members.
The poster boy of the church, yes. I believe, would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he actually has a B.S. in Business Administration and an MBA degree, but as I mentioned, spent 6 years as a fighter pilot in West Germany and spent 30 years... with Lufthansa, as a pilot, as a trainer of other pilots, as a head chief pilot, and a senior vice president of flight operations. This is someone who knows the world extremely well, has traveled the world. And the thing that struck me, and of course this is, I tend to think him as one of the newer apostles. And I was startled when I looked at this to realize that at this point he's fourth in succession for the presidency. And the three men ahead of him are all in their 80s. Mm-hmm. He could very easily be the first president of the church who is both foreign-born and non-native English speaker. Mm-hmm. That could happen very, very easily. Mm-hmm. And of course, everyone loves his talks. He just always has that smile, always has his flight analogies. Anyway, Kevin, thoughts?
Well, I remember him saying that he saw the bumper sticker with this tattooed, bearded guy driving by, and the bumper sticker said, "Don't look down on me because I sin differently than you do." Mm-hmm. And I think there's a tremendous, humanizing, a pull the mote out of your own eye kind of thing that comes out of his talks, and that this is really what the gospel is. It should be doing it. It's not creating barriers, and us and them, but in inclusion and wanting us to see that we are all children of God. And I've always love that about Elder Uchtdorf. Also just the perspective that he gives when he told the story about having to deliver papers as a kid, and he thought, oh, then I'll get this cool bike, and he got this horrible bicycle that was very, very difficult to ride, but he had to do it, to deliver the papers. And then years later, when he was getting a physical to be a fighter pilot, they said, oh, did you know that you had asthma? You must have done something to help strengthen your lungs. Mm. And it was that experience. So something that was difficult, unpleasant, and even embarrassing in his youth, he realized later that it was preparatory for him. And that's a reminder. We think of these guys, you know, it's easy for a young person to look at them and say, well, they're old and out of touch. But the great secret that we learn as we grow older, in every young person, or in every old person, there's a young person wondering what happened.
Oh, yeah. We all know that, don't we?
We all know that. We all know that, you know. Cause, you know, I can still vividly remember crawling around under the benches when I was a little boy at church, you know, when I was a rugrat. I vividly remember that. Mm-hmm. My dad was in, the second counselor in the bishopric, and mom was, you know, trying to herd the six of us, you know, by herself during those meetings. That was a vivid memory, and it doesn't seem like it was all that long ago that all of this time has gone by, and I'm sure that's the same with all of these men. You know, when they tell stories from their youth or mm-hmm. about their sons, that it's vivid for them, and then they have this broad education and broad experience, and plus just the travel in the church and the reporting, and so they hear the stories, and not just, you know, the glowing stories, they hear the stories about the struggles and things that have gone wrong.
Chris.
Elder Uchtdorf brings a depth and breadth of experience to the brotherhood that we simply don't find in among the others because of his circumstances living as a youth in Germany and experiencing that catastrophic World War II where 50 million people were not only killed, but the dislocation of peoples and populations was absolutely extraordinary, and he was part of that. And this is one of the things that I so admire about him, and this is where his understanding is so important in the world that we live in today. He was a refugee. We live in a world that is just filled with chaos and upheaval. I don't presume that it is going to get better anytime soon. I was in Africa last summer, and you know, you see all the different challenges that people are facing. We're looking at what's happening in the Middle East. The brethren, President Holland and President Nelson, were hurried out a little early Saturday just because of the tensions there in the Middle East today. And you are seeing populations on the move today because of the chaos in the world. And he taps in and he understands that on a very personal level that most of us don't. And so his empathy and his understanding for these people and for the reality of the atonement of Jesus Christ combined, I think that's what helps make him that exquisite speaker that he is.
Thank you. For those of you listening, our call-in number is area code 801-254-1640. Area code 801-254-1640. And again, this is the Interpreter Radio Show. We now come to an interesting break as we go through these brethren. The rest of the Quorum of the Twelve, with one exception, are in their 60s or younger. We have this cohort of these apostles who've been called over the last several years who are actually all from early to late 60s, and then we have Elder Suarez, who's just 59. This is a group of apostles who are going to be with us for quite some time to come and who are going to help to shape the future of the church. You have Elder Bednar, who's only 65, and is of course, I feel inadequate every time Elder Bednar talks, and I don't mean that from a negative point of view. Mm-hmm. This is a man whose humility and spirituality comes through so clearly every time he talks, precisely because he doesn't do anything to promote himself. He doesn't, of course, none of the brethren do, but I mean, you hear him, and you immediately start looking at your life and saying, you know, what do I need to do to live my life in such a way that I'm on the same spiritual plane as Elder Bednar? He has great academic qualifications, has a BA in communications, an MA in organizational communications, and a PhD in organizational behavior from Purdue, and of course was president of BYU Idaho for several years. But beyond that, he just, when he talks, I know it's a lot like when I open the Book of Mormon. When Elder Bednar talks, I know I'm going to find something I need to repent of. Not because he's up there preaching repentance. He's up there very humbly as a servant of Christ talking about the things that are really important and that really matter. Mm-hmm. And it makes me stop and look at the things that I fill my life with that really don't matter. Gives me great cause to reconsider how I am living my life. I feel like a lot of what I spend my time on is frivolous after I've listened to Elder Bednar. Chris, your thoughts?
Elder Bednar, to me, is one of these individuals, and all the brethren, of course, but in different ways, they are articulating the doctrine of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But he is... he has doctrinal mastery that you don't see in many others, and he is completely on point from the beginning to the end of his talks. He is articulating the doctrine of the gospel of Jesus Christ for us, and I think this is then where we begin to revisit our lives and our practices, because as he goes through and teaches us in the way that he teaches us, and it is masterful, then we begin to reflect on ways that we can improve and ways that we can do better.
Kevin, I think we're about to come up on a break here.
I can be brief.
Okay, be brief.
When he speaks, you can always tell that he's seeking to please God rather than man.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, wonderful description of it. Again, this is the Interpreter Radio Show. We will be on actually until 9 o'clock tonight. If you want to call in, our number is 801-254-1640, 801-254-1640. You can look at the materials we have online at interpreterfoundation.org and mormoninterpreter.com. And we'll be back after the break. Welcome back. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. Love to have you call in. You can call in at 801-254-1640. 801-254-1640. We have Chris Fredrickson. We have Kevin Christensen. And I'm your host tonight, Bruce Webster. We've been talking about the professional and educational background of the members of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Elder Quentin L. Cook is next, and as I mentioned, we're now getting into this whole cohort of apostles who are all pretty much in their 60s. So once again, I mean, it's pretty much the age that the three of us are. In fact, one of them, Garrett Gong, I know personally because he and I started BYU. And I mentioned this in the previous show that we were friends our freshman year, and if I had picked someone my freshman year, most likely to become an apostle, I probably would have picked Garrett.
Wow.
So that was no surprise. As I said, we entered at the same time. We both had the same scholarship. We lived in the dorms on the same floor. Mm-hmm. And he went on to be a Rhodes Scholar, and I went on to be a computer programmer. So that's sort of the bifurcation that happened there. But let's talk about Quentin Cook, BA in Political Science from the University of Utah, and a law degree from Stanford Law School. Elder Cook, I enjoy his talks. I must confess, I can't sit here and say, well, I remember this particular talk that he gave, but the talks are good, solid doctrine and practical application of that doctrine. Here's what you need to do. You know, here's what we learn about in the scriptures or through the living prophets, and here's... how it needs to go. As you said, this is the second of three lawyers that we have there, which probably is no coincidence that we have Elder Oaks in the First Presidency and two lawyers among the Quorum of the Twelve, given the growing legal issues that the Church faces, and some very tricky legal issues that have to do with freedom of religious expression, freedom of religious practice, so on and so forth. Kevin, your thoughts?
I was just looking at one of his last talk here just now, just so that I have something good to talk about. And I like this comment here that he says that as we look at the primary purposes of the church, they are all based on equality before the Lord and following the culture of the gospel of Jesus Christ. With respect to missionary work, the principal qualifications for baptism are humbling oneself before God and coming forth with a broken heart and a contrite spirit. Education, wealth, race, or national origin are not even considered. So again, it's this inclusive, pure scripturally based focus on the gospel, and definitely, you know, as the title of this talk was, Prepare to Meet God. And at some point, you know, that's really the thing. And there's a line in Hamlet, where, you know, the thing that makes it Hamlet a tragedy is because Hamlet doesn't take the good advice, that the readiness is all. And that he's talking about the readiness to meet God, that if we live that way, rather than, you know, worrying about, you know, I need to get revenge, I need to satisfy my ambitions, all of that, all of those things and all the characters that are caught up in those things in Hamlet all end up tragically. But if you live your life to prepare to meet God, then there is no tragedy that can really touch you. You know, whether you go through afflictions or difficulties, then that preparation to meet God is something that you take. And that's really the only thing worth taking.
Chris, your thoughts?
You know, I'm another one of those that I can't say off the top of my head. There's a favorite talk I've had by Elder Cook. But he does, again, he treats those doctrinal topics, and he does it well. He brings a kind of a lawyer's, not the same kind of style. And I'm not trying to be glib here, but I'm sure you've seen online there are individuals, and everyone has a certain persona when they speak or when they write. And so there are people that always will, you know, some of the apostles, they will go on and they will do a certain style that, you know, like my mom gave me a candy bar, but she said I had to share it with everyone. And, you know, and so, of course, they're talking about President Monson. And Elder Cook is one of those that he loses himself in the word. It's not as if he's trying to build himself up. We just mentioned this before about Elder Bednar, but he's there to help people better understand the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Thank you. Elder Deacon Todd Christofferson, he's sort of the old man of this cohort. He's 53, or 73. I think of his smile. Mm-hmm. He always has a smile on his face when he stands, and he just looks joyful. He's standing up there. He's thrilled to be there. He gives these wonderful talks that tend to be very motivating and very uplifting. Again, we have our third lawyer on the thing. Any mm-hmm. thoughts, Chris? Any?
Yes, I know he's very involved, and rightly so, again, in the defense of religious liberty. And it's not just the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but the brethren certainly are aware of some of the challenges and the false claims that are being made about people of religious persuasion. And I know he's very involved in that. One of the things that I particularly love about Elder Christofferson is, you know, we're very aware of his family circumstances. But he obviously grew up in a home where what we were just talking about is true, where Heavenly Father loves everyone that has ever lived on this planet. And I think he comes from a family where that was not something that was just talked about, but something that was articulated and lived over and over and over again. And so his concern in his outreach to people who do not share our beliefs or our faith, and his love for his fellow men is extraordinary, and it comes through in everything he says, and I think that's what sort of prompts that sweet smile that you always see on his face.
Kevin, thoughts?
Yeah, again, the warmth that he shows is always very distinctive and definitely from the heart. And like in this last conference, again, I was just glancing at his talk, and there's a balance in the talk of practical, organizational discussion of the current changes and the reasons for them, and then he goes into and telling very personal stories about personal Christ-like service and that being the center of all of this. So he's always keeping perspective, and in the practical day-to-day, it's not just about who's in charge or how it's organized or, you know, what the reports look like, but it's the human touch and the way that we can touch each other through these organizations and through these callings. And clearly, he's in the way that he talks and thinks, he clearly knows personally how a person can and does serve Jesus.
Thank you. Now, Neil L. Anderson is next. Has a bachelor's in economics and an MBA from Harvard Business School. Again, you have these excellent qualifications for helping to run this worldwide church. Let me just interject a story in here. Because of that, and also in light of the reorganization and so on, many years ago, this was probably 15 years ago, maybe longer, close to 20, that's sort of scary. was in Washington, D.C., and at the time I was ward mission leader, and we had a young man who was a recent convert at the church. He was a graduate student in organizational behavior at, I believe, American University. And I taught the Gospel Essentials class, and one Sunday it was just me and him, and we were talking. He said, you know, something that strengthens my testimony to the church. He said, I study organizational behavior. I'm, you know, doing my graduate work in it right now. He says, the church shouldn't work. He says, you have this global organization run by untrained volunteers spread literally all over the world with, and at that point it was about 12 million members. And he said, by all standards of organizational behavior, it should split and splinter and break into a million little pieces. He says, part of my testimony since joining the church has been to find out that the church just functions, not only functions, but functions close to identically wherever you go in the world. And he says, my only explanation is basically the power of the priesthood and the power of the Holy Ghost. Mm-hmm. That it is through these channels that the Lord directs his work and adapts it now as, and Chris can talk to this even better than I can, but as a amateur student of church history, I've been fascinated to study in particular how priesthood offices have changed, priest organization has changed at various times in church history, right down to the quote that I think it may have been, who was it? Was it Elder Christofferson who during a priesthood session, gave the revelation that the Lord gave to John Taylor. Basically, the Lord saying, I will continue to change the organization of the priesthood from time to time as it is necessary and as it suits me. And, you know, you have this great reorganization that happened under Brigham Young just before his death, which laid a lot of the modern groundwork. You had another significant reorganization, particularly the move towards Aaronic priesthood as being principally for youth, and in preparation that happened in the early 20th century. I happened to be a 70, an ordained 70, when President Benson, back in 1986, dissolved all the 70s quorums and presidencies. In fact, I like to say I was actually a president of 70 at one point on a stake level. And so when the announcement was made of the current change, for me, from a historical perspective, it made perfect sense. And here's part of my perspective. Today at church, our stake president was there, released the existing high priest group, released the existing elders quorum presidency, and called the new elders quorum presidency. Now, the new elders quorum president is actually not only a high priest, but one of the older high priests in the ward. And it was very interesting because as I sat and watched this and saw him sustained, saw his counselors sustained, and our stake president had asked the Ward Relief Society president to be present for that change, both to see it and because he had things he wanted to address to both of them. I had a very powerful sense that this will be seen in retrospect as a significant change for the towards the parallelization of the Relief Society and the Melchizedek priesthood within the ward. Particularly since an issue came up about committees, because, you know, are we going to have committees on the Elders Quorum President? And the stake president, without getting too explicit, basically said, well, I'm going to leave that up to the bishop and the Relief Society president and the Elders Quorum president. And I got a real sense that there may be some committees organized that have representatives from both the Elders Quorum and the Relief Society, which would be a major change as far as cross-coordination between Relief Society and Elders Quorum. So I'll be fascinated to see that. Just since we've got a few minutes here before the hour break, Chris, your thoughts on that, particularly as someone who's well-versed in church history.
Not as well-versed as I'd like to be, but, and you know, when you're talking about these brethren, really, across the board, you look at Elder Anderson, you look, this is an exquisite business background, and his ability as an organizational leader. And when you have a worldwide organization, which the church is today, it takes an enormous amount of oversight. And what you said is what I have always loved when I travel, when I have the opportunity to travel. One of the things that I always love is one of my very favorite things is to go to church in countries around the world. You know, when I was in Africa, I ended up in primary, and they're teaching the same lessons that, you know, and I was asked to step in and teach a primary class because they had somebody not show up. It is definitely, some things never change, do they? and I had that opportunity to teach these lovely little, you know, 11 and 12-year-olds. And but the brethren, one of the things that they're very keen on is making sure that the doctrine is as pure as possible. That's what holds the church together. And then, of course, you see this structure that's now being articulated that understands this new generation of spirits that's coming to the earth and their capacity and their spiritual capacity to do and to understand. And so I think this is a lot of these changes and to minister, because that is all Jesus Christ did his entire life. And so we're refining and we're redefining, and there's certainly a place for women in this church as there has always been. But as societies are more open to the leadership of women, we're seeing some great movement, you know, with regards to women's involvement and their voices in the church today. And it's they've always been there, but they're very powerful today. And we've got exquisite women along with exquisite men that are leaders in this church today.
Thank you, Kevin. If you hold your comments, we actually have our first caller of the evening. Caller, you can go ahead, give us your name and your question or comment.
Yeah, this is the Eagle from Southern Utah. In 1982, I was asked to go into a bishopric in the Sugar House area, and the strangest thing to me since that day, I have seen a tendency for the church to consolidate power rather than to let it out and let people develop by exercise.
Let's hold your question till after the break. We came in early here, so I'll put you on hold. If you hang on, we'll get back to you. This is the Interpreter Radio Show.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Interpreter Radio Show. This is Bruce Webster, your host. We've got Chris Fredrickson here in the studio and Kevin Christensen on the phone. And we had our first caller, Eagle from Southern Utah. Can you just start over again? Because the radio station was sort of stepping on the comments that you're making.
Sure. I was introduced to a bishopric by being called into it and how they operate. And it seems to me that what the church is going through is an adjustment to consolidate power and authority rather than to let it flow out into the membership and let them learn by their mistakes. That's just my comment from looking at the inside. I've had personal acquaintances with many of the prophets in the last 40 years, and I find them to be very, very accommodating, but then when it comes to the policies, the actual policies of the church, I find that they're gathering more power towards the center. Can you comment on that? And I'll hang up and listen to you.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. It's interesting comments. I'm not entirely sure what you mean by consolidation. I've served in two bishoprics. I just finished a stint as a High Councilman for the last 3 years, and so have been pretty much for about 30 years, and that's sort of scary to think about because it was 30 years ago I first served in a bishopric. For the vast majority of that time have been in PECs, and for the last 3 years in state high councils as well. And my claim would be just the opposite. The push towards a church, while there is, and Chris can talk about this because she and I were talking about over the break, over the need for consistency and purity in doctrine and practice, the responsibility I keep seeing being pushed down more and more into members. Kevin, we didn't get to you at the break, so let me toss this to you first, and then we'll come back to Chris.
Well, I haven't served in bishopric, so I've just been a lay member the whole time that I've been in the church. And I've seen my wife as a Relief Society president on three different occasions, and I know that she's always, you know, been involved with decisions and gone to councils and has called on me to be the, you know, the day laborer in support of that. But, it's, for, as far as, from my perspective, it's all service. And wherever we serve and however we serve, there's, you know, our circumstances, our personalities and things, and, the thing that I found most useful in dealing with it was looking up the definition of sustain in a good dictionary. Because it turns out that it doesn't mean what we think it means, but what it means is really just exactly what the community needs.
Okay, Chris, your comments?
We are a church of lay members, and we are human. One of the things I like to remind my students in my classes up at BYU is that I can promise you that at some point in time in your membership in the church, you will be offended by someone. And I can also promise you that at some time in your membership in the church, you will offend someone. Because we're human. And so, you know, we are a collection of imperfect human beings trying to do, but I would suggest that people that take sincerely their callings try to do the best that they can in their callings. But you do find sometimes where mistakes are made. And then let me speak to your point here. And your point is about, you know, the leadership of the church. And I was mentioning to Bruce that one of the things that's fascinating to me about the church and the organizational structure, and we're talking about the organization, is that if you look at the Catholic Church is authoritarian, theoretically, top down. And that's the model in the Catholic Church. If you look at many of these sort of evangelical faiths, and if you look at like the Quakers, for instance, what they do is they gather together. It's very ecumenical. They keep silence until the Spirit moves upon them, and then they stand up and they will share with others what the Holy Spirit has taught them to teach others. So that's a very ground roots kind of an organizational structure where everyone has power and authority. But what we find in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is we find a church where you find both elements. You do have those that are in authority, and this is where I think the consolidation is not necessarily a negative thing, but their duty and responsibility is to protect the doctrine of the church. This is why we ended up with an apostasy after the time of Jesus Christ, because individuals begin misinterpreting, and Jesus Christ makes it very clearly clear to us, and I can't remember where I was just reading, but I'm getting ready for a trip to Israel, and so, you know, I've been reading through the New Testament again, but Jesus Christ makes it very clear that, you know, do not teach any more or any less than I teach you. And so the church went astray, and what we saw was we saw the misrepresentation of doctrine that brings individuals to salvation. But what you do find in the church, which is absolutely extraordinary, is that you find the diffusion of priesthood power and authority as widely as possible. To be perfectly honest, I would not necessarily trust my 12-year-old child with the keys to if I had a Bugatti or if I had the most expensive car on the planet. And yet, look at what the Savior Jesus Christ does. He tells these young boys that he is giving them at a very young age duties and responsibilities in priesthood power and authority. And priesthood power, as President Oakes made very clear in his seminal talk on women in the priesthood, was that priesthood power and authority is available to women in the church as well. And so there is this extraordinary diffusion of power. And this is what the Lord wants. And I also think we're moving to an era, because of the spirits that are coming now, because of the growth of the church and the kind of leadership and the kind of spiritual capacity, that's what ministering is. This whole, you know, intention here is you don't follow this rigorous program, but your duty and responsibility is to be Christ-like in your relationship with others, to be truly Christ-like, and to mirror and to mimic Jesus Christ's actions and behaviors towards others. And I find that just an extraordinary kind of a new kind of a program that we are moving towards. But it's essential in the world that we live in today, where we're so assaulted by different voices, that we need to be in touch with the Spirit.
Thank you. Getting back to our list of going through the apostles and their backgrounds, we have Elder Ronald A. Rasband, who attended the University of Utah. I think he's the other one of our apostles who didn't actually complete a degree, and spent most of his professional career working for various divisions of the Huntsman Corporation, ending up on at pretty much very highest levels at Huntsman. This is a man with broad, extensive international business experience, great organizational perception, And again, as per Chris's comments earlier, we have a worldwide church that, you know, with 16 million members currently, that manages to run itself without falling apart. And I think it's because of some of the organizational brilliance. And particularly, I go back, honestly, one of my areas of personal and professional study is what's called complexity theory, which is how you have intelligence behavior arise out of small independent agents who behave according to a carefully chosen set of small intelligent rules. And you get things like flocking behavior of birds. They don't collide with each other. They're not talking to each other. You know, no one's sitting, telling them all what to do, and yet you can see these enormous flocks of birds that can maneuver without ever colliding. and one of the things that hit me when I was early into my study of complexity theory is I thought, oh my gosh, this is Joseph Smith. I teach them correct principles and they govern themselves. Mm-hmm. The church runs because we have these correct principles that are pushed down, both in terms administratively, organizationally, and in terms of the gospel. Mm-hmm. This is how you do it. This is what you do. A lot of you may recall several years ago, Elder Holland was sent to, I want to say the Philippines and Elder Oaks to South America, maybe the other way around, for a year. And the reason was the church growth had been so explosive in those two regions that we were having to organize units where members were too new to know how the church was supposed to run. And so we actually, the two apostles spent a year in their respective locations training and overseeing the church leadership and helping to establish those correct principles. This is how the church is organized, this is how it's run, and so on, so that the growth did not outrun the organizational strength of the church. Kevin, any thoughts on your part?
Yeah, we're talking about church organization. There's a guy named John Boyd, who is a fighter pilot and a theorist, and he talked about the OODA loop, which is observe, collect data, orient yourself, you know, form a perspective, make a decision, and then act and play out decisions. And his theory was that large organizations, and that includes the church, all have these loops at different levels. And he says that the most effective organizations have a highly decentralized chain of command that utilizes objective-driven orders or directive control rather than method-driven orders in order to harness the mental capacity and creative abilities of individual commanders. And I look at the church and I think, yeah, that's what we've got. You know, there's the at a local level, we have decisions to make here. And you know, right where I am is with the callings that I have, with where I serve, I've got decisions to make every time I open my mouth or every time I act. And I've seen my wife doing those too and her colleagues. And we, you know, in teaching primary as a, you know, the calling that we had lately was we had a group of 6 and 7 year olds and we had to do the lessons. We had to make our choices. We had, you know, a certain amount of prepared materials to deal with, but we also had to deal with the particular group of children that we had. And I watched my wife take leadership and make great decisions, and we had a good experience there.
And, you know, here's what's important. Again, today at church for us, when our stake president was talking, and he directly addressed both the Relief Society president and the New Elders Quorum president, called them both president. Instead of Sister Peterson, he called her President Peterson. And he looked at them and said, your responsibility is to relieve the burden on the bishop so he can focus on his most important priorities, which are the youth of the ward and taking care of the poor and needy in the ward. Then he looked at the rest of us and said, your responsibility is to relieve the burden on these two presidents, the Relief Society president and the Elders Quorum president. We need your service to relieve their burden so they can focus on the things that are most important in their callings. And that, yeah, I love your use of the OODA loop, because that is very much what we push down. And again, as per the comment I made earlier about the brother that studying organizational behavior, it is because of the gift of the Holy Ghost, in my opinion, the gift of the Holy Ghost and the power of the priesthood, and how that power is delegated by setting apart both men and women, and thereby exercised by both men and women, that the church functions so well in spite of our imperfections. Mm-hmm. Particularly if you study some of the organizational issues in other religions and some of the splinters and schisms that can happen, both on a congregational level and on a very broad church-wide level. It is remarkable to see the cohesion and consistency within a church. Chris, mm-hmm. a few thoughts?
I'm just going to jump in. I loved your comment on observe, orient, and act. But I would just, if I was kind of quantifying the model in the church, it's observe, ponder, pray, orient, and act. And that's the exquisiteness of the gospel of Jesus Christ, is that as we are willing to turn, we can get the guidance and direction that's necessary. That, you know, I mean, we have foibles, we have weaknesses, we're humans, we are going to make mistakes along the way, but there's this exquisite blessing of that Holy Ghost that will aid us. I teach it, you know, I teach history, and I've taught, as I mentioned, you know, in the religion department at BYU. I find that when I teach my history classes, and even I even pray over those, that I'll have opportunities to, that I'll be factual and accurate and, you know, have a better, broader understanding, so that I can help my students to have a better, broader understanding. But I have a curriculum that I generally follow. When I teach my religion classes, it's quite fascinating to me is that I go into the classroom, obviously with a prayer as well, and we start with a prayer there. But I find that, that curriculum, although I have a curriculum, it's not as rigid. It's driven by the Spirit, and the Spirit's going to and I find too that classes have a certain character. There will be times in the semester where I'm spending a lot of time talking about morality issues. There will be times when I'm talking about word of wisdom. There'll be times when I'm talking about same-sex attraction. You know, classrooms have a character themselves, and students bring their concerns and their interests, and so you'll find yourself dealing with those things. This is how the church operates as well as it does.
Thank you very much, Chris. Well, we'll take a brief break here for pay the bills, and then we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Interpreter Radio Hour. I'm your host, Bruce Webster. We've got Kevin Christensen on the phone, and we've got Chris Fredrickson here in the studio. If you want to call us, our number is 801-254-1640, 801-254-1640. We've been talking tonight about the educational and professional background of the leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, working our way through. And we're now up to Elder Gary E. Stevenson of the Quorum of the Twelve. A relatively young, 62, has a degree in business administration from Utah State University, founded Icon Health and Fitness in 1977 and worked there for 30 years, retiring as CEO when he got called into full-time church service. So once again, we have someone not just with business service, but with entrepreneurial business service. As someone who's been involved in a couple of software startups through my career, I can tell you that starting and running your own business is an education. You learn the very hard realities about making payroll each week, about, you know, how much funds you have in the bank and when you will run out if you do not get more funds in the bank. I learned some very important lessons about that along the way. So once again, we have another one of our apostles who's got grounded real-world experience, who knows the ups and downs of trying to build a business, of having a professional life, and so on. And that's the interesting thing. I mean, getting back to Chris's comment about comparing it to both Catholic and evangelical churches, you have the issue that we don't have a professional priesthood. They're really... If you set aside mission presidents, there's about 100 church leaders who actually get a living allowance from the church. As Michael Quinn showed in his latest book, it's actually relatively modest compared to comparative executive salaries. And the interesting thing I find is surveying church history is I know of no financial scandals among the leadership of the church. You don't see issues of actual enrichment or, you know, having these, you know, big houses or private jets, except in cases where they had already earned that money before they were called full-time church leadership. I also, during my 3 years in the High Council, I was one of the stake auditors. So I, twice a year, I helped conduct, or actually did conduct, the stake audits for selected wards within a stake. Church takes its finances and the care of those finances very seriously. I have a story that I would tell when I would do the audits. Back in Washington, D.C., I was serving in the bishopric of the ward and had the bishop, Lou Hampton, said caught me at church and said, Bruce, we've got someone from church audit who wants to talk to us. And I'm kind of like, oh, well, that's interesting. And at that point, one of my responsibilities in the church was, or in the ward, I was one over welfare. So I was the one who wrote most of the checks. And this was an actual physical checkbook. They all do it electronically now and print them out on the printer. But this was a classic long style with stubs along one side. And this fine brother from Salt Lake City put down a Xerox copy of two checks and said, are those your signatures on these checks? And I looked at them and I said, no. I said, that's actually not a bad forgery, but those are not my signatures. And what this was is that a former financial clerk in our ward had forged two checks to himself. Basically, he had written out two checks to himself, had signed it because he had the authorization to sign it, but it requires two signatures, and he forged my signature. Wow. Apparently got a copy of my signature somewhere and practiced it and forged it. it's very sobering to see your signature on forged checks. But someone at church headquarters had apparently been doing some sort of review and audit and noted that these signatures looked different enough from my other signatures on other checks.
Wow.
That they considered it worth coming out and investigating. the church, there are those who complain that the church should be more open about its finances. Most private organizations will tell you, no, we're not going to tell you anything about our finances because that's why we're a private organization instead of a publicly traded corporation. I have no particular problem with that issue, but that's a long around to the fact that the church leadership has among it very solid, very high-powered business administration background and reality of finances.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, thoughts?
And correct me if I'm wrong, my husband's a ward clerk right now, and as I understand it, those quarterly reports, if they're not in on time, you don't get the funds from the church until those are in. Because he got a letter basically from the stake clerk reminding him that those need to be in, that that's a very serious matter. The other thing that kind of shocks me, stuns me, because I could never do this, is the fact that they have to account for every single penny spent.
Oh, yeah.
If they can't have it down to the penny, if I can get within, well, if I even balance my checkbook, I just look at the bank and see how much I've got left. But if I can, you know, even get within $5 or $10, I'm like, that's good enough for me. But the church is very serious, and the oversight in the church is significant for this very reason. They take very seriously their accountability, not just to the members of the church, but to the Lord, to use this money appropriately. And so we have all of these checks and balances in place, which should be so comforting to members of the church.
Yeah, the Lord, and that's usually part of my standard spiel as a stake auditor, is the Lord cares very much about the widow's mite, and he mm-hmm. does not take lightly to those who fail to very carefully track the funds. Kevin, comments?
Well, yeah, speaking of the widow's mite, my dad was either a state clerk or a ward clerk for a lot of his life. And my sister inherited those genes. She got a CPA. And for a while after kids were gone, she worked in the church office building as a very senior accountant, and so was involved there. And she was there when President Hinckley went from being, you know, the de facto president to the actual president, and, you know, was there and involved in. So she saw all that was going on financially, and she was very impressed with it. And she talked about one meeting where President Hinckley was going to address, you know, the financial department of the church, and he just came in and he said, "I had some prepared remarks, but I just want you to treat every penny like it's the widow's mite." And that's all he said.
Yeah, and it, and like I said, they do take that very seriously. We do have a caller. Caller, you're on the line. Can you give us your name and give us your comment or question?
Yeah, my name's Dean. And anyway, this church finance stuff, you know, brings a lot of question in my mind. I'm a, I guess, so-called member. I can get discouraged at times because my financial and legal situation is pretty grim. And, you know, as far as where this authority is now, where, you know, like you was saying, where the bishop can worry about the poor and the needy and the youth in the ward, what happens when you don't have a ward or you're homeless, you know? Mm-hmm. The so-called transient bishop is a florist. And, you know, I've been through it for years. I've really not got down to begging get down on my knees and begging. It just gets to the point where even a discussion around any sort of financial arrangement is pretty well ushered out of the room and, or just, you know, moved on to not my bailiwick. And, find it discouraging, you know, where I see all these church properties and stuff and these farms that have been purchased up by the church for merely pennies or donated and then turned into this Babylonian empire, as far as I'm concerned, or leased out to other farmers. It looks to me like they're just building their own little country club, and I wouldn't begin to try to bring anybody into this church right now in a missionary fashion, because I guess you could say I have a chip on my shoulder.
Well, I appreciate your comments. Let me speak to that a bit, because as I mentioned, as a bishop in D.C., I was the one over welfare. I was the one writing the checks. Now, and this is, I have spent literally my whole life in various locations doing service in church welfare organizations. In San Diego, we canned tuna. It was not a popular welfare assignment, and I had one pair of sneakers that I used for no other reason than working at the tuna cannery, because you could never get the smell out. I have worked on various welfare farms. I worked at the cannery, and by worked, I mean did volunteer work at the cannery in Denver. The church does its best to take care of those in need. Now, there are differences or challenges in how they deal with that. And, you know, sometimes the bishop or the counselor may have different decisions or criteria. Let me give you a different perspective as to, let me say two things. First, no, there is no Babylonian Empire. The church leadership is not rich. They are not enriched by their leadership in a church. They are not benefited. A lot of the church funds go overseas to help the members there. Right now, in fact, I have good friends who work in facilities management. That was my responsibility as a stakeout councilman, plus back in Denver for 9 years. I was very close friends with one of the church full-time facilities management employees out there. Right now, the church has severely restricted its spending on building and improvements here in North America because it wants to use those funds in Africa and the Philippines and Southeast Asia and various developing countries where the needs are great. That is where this money and where the welfare supplies are going to. The church has spent over $1 billion in humanitarian aid not directed to church members, directed to the population of the world at large over the last 25 years. This is not some big business Babylonian empire. This is a church that practiced conservative fiscal practices conservative fiscal policies, that does not pay its employees terribly well, as anyone who's worked for a church can tell you. It's not what you go into to get ahead in terms of money or business. Speaking as an adjunct professor at BYU, I can also tell you that, you know, salaries at BYU are not exactly the sort of things. And Chris can tell me even, can talk even more than that. Mm-hmm. So I would greatly disagree with your characterization. Now, as far as the issues with the transient population, this is just tough all the way around. And I say this because I have an extended family member who frankly is has serious substance abuse problems, and pretty much she and her partner move from locale to locale, find a bishop, get help, get a lot of stuff done, usually find members, get stuff from them, and then they disappear and go to the next area, the next ward. And once a bishop has been through this once or twice, they tend to become more cautious, rightly or not. They tend to become more cautious as to what they're doing, precisely because of that reason. Chris, comments?
Yeah, let me just jump in here. You know, your name was again what? Caller? What
Dean.
Was your, excuse
Dean
me.
Dean Spencer.
Steve.
Dean.
Dean.
Thank you very much, Dean. You know what, Dean? There's nothing more grinding and discouraging than being without just the basic resources that you need to live. It's heart-wrenching. I honestly believe that any, you know, true faithful member of the church, aware of other people's circumstances, would do what they can to help. Being a transient, you know, I don't know if you're in the transient population. That makes it very difficult sometimes to reach out and help. I've got a cousin that struggles, and that certainly has been aided and assisted for much of her life by the church because of her circumstances and conditions. It breaks my heart anytime, you know, and the opportunities I've had to travel and to see the suffering. And you know what? It's not just around the world. It's right here in our own backyard. And there are so many people with such great needs. And I do honestly, sincerely believe my responsibility as a member of the church is to aid and assist whenever possible, and the church members and leaders' responsibility is to aid and assist as much as possible those that are in need. And, you know, we've had times in our life when it's been pretty challenging financially, and although we haven't had to take advantage of the resources of the church, it was a comfort to us because we knew, and we were encouraged to do as much as possible on our own, to go to our families first, and, you know, as a last recourse to tap into the church resources. But we knew that we had friends and loved ones, and that the church was there if there was an egregious need, and that they would be there to help us. And I firmly believe that. And I truly hope that you will find a bishop and reach out and help him better understand your condition so that you can get the help that you need, because there's nothing worse than that kind of suffering.
Kevin, we're going to go to break pretty quick here. Any thoughts quickly?
Well, just echoing that, my wife has been Relief Society president on several occasions, so she's known about that, and we've been hands-on about helping and seeing how the church has been able to help people. Also, you know, there was a period when I was out of work for 16 months straight, and so I felt like I'd fallen off the economy and didn't know how to get back on. But, you know, anything like this, all that we can do is get through one day at a time and do the best we can and hope to get to that part where things change. Because, as I say, since that period, you know, I've got the best job I've ever had, and I've been in a situation where we've been able to help other people that have been in financial and legal struggles, and have seen positive outcomes, even though going through the story was very hard.
Okay, we've got a break here. We've got two callers on hold. Of callers, if you'll wait, we'll come back to you as soon as the break's over. Thank you very much. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. Welcome back. This is the final segment of the Interpreter Foundation radio show. Again, we're part of the Interpreter Foundation at mormoninterpreter.com and interpreterfoundation.org. We have a caller on the line. Caller, please give us your name and your question or comment.
Yes, excellent show, Bruce, Chris, and Kevin. Excellent show.
Oh, thank you.
And yes, and my name's Ray, and I was once a ward finance clerk, and I never came across the slightest, you know, misappropriation of funds. I mean, it takes a lot of money to run a ward and a stake, you know, heating, electricity, lighting, and also materials, you know, for all the classrooms, all the children and the teachers, the ward library and everything, and all the checks need two signatures. Yep. You know, it's not just one signature. And I was also a camp caretaker for 3 years over in Camp Woodland. Mm-hmm. And in the stake, there was, it fluctuated between 9 and 14 wards. That, wow. You know, was out in Morgan used Camp Woodland. And that Camp Woodland was bought by, all the, projects from the members out, girls washing cars and,
yeah.
You know, fundraisers, all the members fundraising, buying that property, and that property, you know, is used for, scouting, you know, and then also mainly used for girls camp, mm-hmm. but also, family reunions and ward get togethers, you know, for the, you know, day or something that they have, father and sons, you know, weekend, or even in ours, we had daddy-daughter. Mm-hmm. Daddy-daughter, it was wonderful, you know. And I also served, you know, in the canneries, and these farms brought in a big variety of food. I won't go into it. And then we canned up this food, and this food did not go some went to the church, the needy people in the church. You know, the bishop oversees that, and, you know, but most of it went to world disasters around the world, earthquakes and floods and you name it, you know, and so I'm as a ward member, you know, our fast offerings, it helps our fellow ward members when they're having a illness, you know, leukemia or something, or having an illness, and whatever is left over goes to the stake, and then it goes on up the church and then around the world to help people. I mean, in our church, we don't have a lot of gold icons. We don't have a silver and gold icons all over, you know, and we're not building castles, and the church leaders, I mean, President Monson, anybody who runs a worldwide organization with 16 million people, I mean, I don't know, what do they get, 5 million, 10 million a year? Well, President Monson didn't get anything like that. Well, most of them are independently wealthy, you know, before they became into the church, and they just get traveling and expenses and, So anyway, I just wanted to say from conference that my I no longer have a home teacher. You know, after 14 years, he called me up and he asked me for an appointment and told me his my home minister wanted to make an appointment with me.
those of us who have been around have known how church organizations have changed. My favorite is the Mutual organization back in the 70s went through about 5 name changes over a period of about 10 years before it finally settled on Young Men and Young Women. The interesting thing about the change from home and visiting teaching to ministering is that there's no more reporting on your visits. It's a quarterly reporting on Relief Society presidents and Elder Quorum presidents having personal interviews with the ministers themselves, and I think that it will take a while for that to get in there, but I think that will actually have a profound impact. Thank you very much for your comment. Let's finish up. We have three more apostles here to talk about. We've got Elder Renland, who's got our other doctor. He's got a bachelor's in chemistry and MD from the University of Utah. He was a professor of medicine at the U of U for almost 20 years. And and is actually one of my favorite speakers. He and his wife have extensive experience. He was in the area presidency in South Africa for some years, and they have truly a global perspective on the church and its needs. Chris, comments?
No, I find him, I won't say self-deprecating, but he's very real. He's very real when he speaks, and he's very in tune with, as he speaks, with concerns, real concerns that individuals are facing in the world today, and he addresses them with a prophetic voice.
Thank you. Kevin, thoughts?
I don't have anything to say on him at this point.
The next one, okay, Garrett Gong. As I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. I know Garrett. We're not bosom buddies or whatever thing, but we entered BYU the same year, 1971. We were both Joseph Fielding Smith scholars. We were both in late summer honors. He and I were literally on the same floor in the dorms, and we're both quite active in the honors program, and I knew him through our 4 years there. And Garrett was, and this probably says more about Garrett than anything, what I remember of him, particularly after our freshman year, is we'd run across each other on campus or whatever, and he'd look at me and say, Bruce, what do you think about X? And X was usually some topic that I immediately recognized was probably important and profound and that I really hadn't given any thought to. But Garrett's thing was he would go around and ask his friends. You know, he'd be thinking about some topic, some important issue. Mm-hmm. And part of what he'd do is he'd go around and find people and say, what do you think about this? What are your thoughts? What do you think is important? And so on. I have followed his career since then. Last time I talked to him is when we were both living in D.C. I think at that point he was at the Center for Strategic International Studies. Now, Garrett went on, as I mentioned, he was a Rhodes Scholar. Went to Oxford, has a master's there, has a Ph.D. in international relations, worked for the U.S. State Department, in the Department of State, was a special assistant to the U.S. ambassador to China, then worked at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, in Washington, D.C., which I know of. I actually had dealings with him myself while I was in D.C. This is one of the preeminent foreign policy think tanks in the U.S., and frankly in the world. Then worked for the BYU administration, and he brings a wealth of global knowledge and real-world understanding of politics to the quorum. Not that the rest don't, but this is a very significant calling. Kevin, I'll throw it to you first. Any thoughts on Elder Gong?
Just getting to know him in the past couple of weeks, you know who he is, but I'm very impressed by his background and credentials, and I'm looking forward to seeing how these are used by the church.
Chris?
He brings sterling credentials to an international church. And we live in a world that has to deal with geopolitics these days. I mean, the world is so tightly connected these days in myriad ways that we can't even begin to understand. When there's a little dust-up, in Africa or in the Middle East, it can have enormous worldwide implications. And here's such a bright mind that understands, the geopolitics of the world. And the church operates in a world of politics. And they have to be familiar with conditions on the ground, and they have to understand how countries operate and how they work to their best interest and what their positions and practices, but most importantly, what their perspectives are on the world. We can talk all we want about, the United States should be in here rescuing people here or there, and I'm not trying to get into the political world. But any time the United States acts around the world, from a historical perspective, the concern and interest of most nations around the world is maintaining sovereignty. They want to be sovereign and independent of the power of others. And so we saw throughout European history this establishing a balance of power throughout the world. And so they would jump sides in wars because one state was getting more powerful than another. And so we see this still in the world today. And he understands those different perspectives. When the United States might think that they're acting in a very benign or in a very humanitarian way in reaching out and saving populations, other people might perceive that as nation building. And so here's someone who understands all of those things that will be a great aid and assistance to the church and to the members of the church and to countries around the world where people are not members of the church.
One last observation on Elder Gong. I very much enjoyed his talk in General Conference, and my thought listening to him is this is like Neil Maxwell without the alliteration. Garrett's words are very, very carefully crafted. He will change word order to maximize impact and to make the actual, to say what he wants to get across in as few words as possible. I think he will become, over time, one of the more popular speakers in general conferences. And then we have Elder Ulysses Suarez, age 59, from Brazil. Always useful for North Americans to remember that Brazil has the same rough surface area as the United States. There are, I believe, 29 missions in Brazil currently. It's probably, as far as country goes, it is, I don't know what the church population in Brazil versus Mexico is, but probably comes close to rivaling Mexico as the second largest source of church members in any given country in the world. His background is in accounting and auditing. And in fact, he has actually worked as a senior auditor in the church. He has worked in the church's department on disposition of resources. And he's Brazilian. So we have two non-native English speaker foreign-born apostles right now among the 12. Chris, thoughts?
Both he and Elder Gong bore their testimonies to us in conference. And when you realize the powerful men that these men are, and all these members of the 12 are, and how widely respected they are in their different fields of enterprises, the humility that they bring to their task as apostles should startle us. Most people with the kind of power that they have, certainly it's not hard to be filled with hubris, to be overcome by ego. You don't see that in these individuals. They can be very businesslike. They can be very frank. But that's what was so touching to me, is that level of humility that they bring to their task. And I think, too, that, again, they're going to be a great addition. I've got a daughter-in-law that's from Brazil. And these are an extraordinary people. I love this girl with all my heart. And I think I had two students at BYU. They were from former East Germany that was then grafted into Germany. And one of the things that bothered them as members of the church was that we flew an American flag on the temple in Germany. And it was in Germany, and it was a simple little thing. But what troubled them is that, you know, we had leadership from America. And rightly or wrongly, the Lord's going to prepare those that he sees need to be members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. But the growth that we're seeing in countries around the world, and the inclusion and the outreach to individuals who are spiritual giants in their own right, and we're seeing them now come into the 12 and into the 70, and rightly so, and it's delightful to see that this truly is a worldwide church that's being represented now. And I think we'll see more of that in the future. Thank by you. People from around the world.
Kevin, last thoughts. Whoops. Sorry, Kevin.
I just appreciate. Yep. Okay.
Sorry, Kevin. Sorry.
Not to worry. Not to worry.
This has been this week's edition of the Interpreter Radio Show. Tune in again next week, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, here on KTalk Radio and online at ktalkmedia.com. I apologize. We did have a caller waiting and weren't able to get to him. I apologize, caller.
Kid.